Hey everybody, Jace here. Before we get into the Aftershock Monday episode, I just wanted to remind everyone of a couple of our past episodes, some of the content we've released over the last few days that's of particular note. I wrote an article, didn't release a comic source episode on it, but there are some clips in the article, and it's all about the new Lost in Space Netflix series that debuted Friday, April 13th on Netflix. And something pretty funny happened to me when I was covering the panel and the press room for that series. And it's all explained in the article. As I said, I've gotten a lot of good feedback about the article, so I just wanted to let you all know about that. And then at the press room after, you know, talking to the cast, it's very apparent that they're all heavily invested in the series. I think that the series is excellent. I think everyone should watch it. I think it's very much a family show in keeping with one theme that was pretty prevalent in the original series. And that, again, is the theme of family. So I'm going to play a little snippet from one of the cast members here, Molly Parker, who plays Maureen Robinson. And I'll put a link in the show notes to the article so you can go check it out for yourself.
And you know, it's funny. We didn't talk that much about, like, oh, we're doing something different because these women are strong. I mean, a number of strong women in my career, and one of the things that for me just feels really good about the show is that none of it is spoken about. You know, no one talks about the fact that our daughter is mixed race. Nobody talks about the fact that this woman can do whatever this man can do. Like, we've all been trained, we all have the capacity, we can do what needs to be done.
The other thing that I want to mention, Ninjak vs. the Valiant Universe, the web series, is finally going to be released on April 21st, this coming Saturday. I recently had a chance to sit down and talk with Aaron Shanka, who is the director and one of the producers from Bat in the Sun, and he has worked very, very hard on this project. He's really proud of it, so we're trying to spread the word and make sure when it debuts on Saturday on comicbook.com that it blows up everywhere. So again, a quick snippet from Aaron talking about the show.
And it's like, it's just kind of strange. Like, I've heard directors say, like, the colorful costumes don't work on screen, so we just ditch that. And I'd be like, well, it's your job to make them work. That's, you know, those are the characters that we love. So, and like you're saying, like, as far as the cockiness and as far as the costumes and the look, everything is attention to detail. I mean, the personalities are different. The way that the actors look are different. The way they fight are different. You know, there's so many defining things. I try to think of it sometimes as if I'm like adapting, or making a movie about George Washington or Lincoln, people who really existed, to where you don't have that creative license to change it. It's just what it is, because, you know, Lincoln looked a certain way. He talked a certain way. He conducted himself a certain way. And when they make a movie, they have to subscribe to that. And I think that when you're doing superheroes, you should do that, because that is why they have resonated for so long. I mean, the blueprint for why Superman, Batman, Spider-Man work, you know, that's been around for 50 to 80 years. And I don't know why you'd want to change that.
All right. So I encourage you all to definitely check out Ninjak versus the Valiant Universe when it comes out this coming Saturday. And also go back if you want more information and listen to our Valiant Sunday episode when we had Aaron on and talked all about the series. So now on to the Aftershock Monday episode, everybody. Hope you enjoy it. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is an Aftershock Monday episode, and I'm going to be talking about a couple of the titles coming out from Aftershock this Wednesday, April 18th. We've got Her Infernal Descent number 1, and we have a Rough Riders Ride or Die number 3. So I think I'll talk about her Infernal Descent number one first. It's from writers Lonnie Nadler and Zach Thompson. The art is by Kyle Charles, and the colors are by Dee Cuniff. So this is a modern retelling and reimagining of Dante's Inferno. So for those not familiar, Dante's Inferno is the first of three parts of three different long-form poems that make up Dante's Divine Comedy. And it's a very important piece of literature. It's been studied many times. In fact, I know someone right now who's doing their, I think their PhD work, I think is actually what they're doing. They're doing a doctoral thesis on the Divine Comedy. So, as I said, it's very much a seminal work. It's got a lot of different themes. It deals with sin and humanity's propensity to sin and Christianity and themes of heaven and hell. And there's a lot of stuff in there, a lot of high concepts, ideas. And so when you start talking about adapting something that is so, I don't want to say beloved, but so has been so examined and is such a, like I said, a seminal work, adapting it to a comic story, you kind of wonder, you know, as much as I hate to admit it, comics, at least in the United States, are still looked down upon somewhat. The sequential storytelling, the art of telling a story through sequential art, isn't as respected here as it is other places. So when you take a work like Dante's Inferno that's so noteworthy and talk about adapting it to comics, I think there's a lot of scholars that might scoff at that a little bit. I haven't read all of Dante's Inferno. I read some of it in college for one of my philosophy classes, because again, there are a lot of high concept ideas to think about. But I like the fact that it's being adapted. I like the fact that Nadler and Thompson are taking on such a heady, impactful, you know, bit of fiction and turn it into a comic, because I'm going to understand more of the story. I mean, Dante's Inferno, I think the original was written, maybe in the 14th century? Yeah. So it's not exactly easy to understand, right? With the old English, you know, even translated, it loses something. And there's different versions of the translation, I guess you'd say. So for these two writers to be taking a work that is so, you know, important in fiction and in basically the history of humankind, adapting it in such a way that somebody like me is going to be able to easily read it and still be presented with these same ideas and these same concepts, I think that's great. Right. I think it's a way to expose readers to, you know, some classic literature that they might not otherwise read, you know, a story from classic literature. And, you know, it's not going to be exactly the same, but they are going to be exploring, you know, a lot of those same ideas. So in the original Inferno, the traveler that goes to the underworld is Dante himself, and he's guided there by the Roman poet Virgil. I think he was Roman. Whereas in this version, we see that it's a middle-aged woman. So right away, there's a big difference there. Gender is switched, but it's also the fact that she's a mother, and I think that's going to play a really central role in the story. So she's lost her family, And early on in the story, we see that she's still alive, but she's not living her life, if that makes sense. And I think any of the listeners out there who've lost somebody really close to them or multiple people, you'll kind of understand where I'm going at. It's really easy when you lose somebody, sometimes it's a child or a sibling or a parent, and it's easy to retreat from life. It's easy to become like a hermit and just close yourself off from living and from relationships. And so when her infernal descent starts, that's kind of what we see. This mother has lost her family, her beloved family, and she's still alive, as I said, and living in the same house, almost literally with the ghosts of her family that she's lost. But she's not really living, right? She's alive, but she's not living because she's not interacting. She's not feeling. She's stopped growing. She's completely stagnated, and she's just stuck. And she goes up to her attic for reasons that aren't entirely clear. She is sort of packing up the house, sort of, and has been doing so for quite a while. But the house is also in disarray. And so anyway, she gets up to the attic. She meets William Blake, who talks in this rhyme scheme that's really clever. And it's got to be a challenge for the writers at times to have Blake say what he needs to say and stick with this rhyming pattern. I'm sure that they've spent many an hour on that. And Blake convinces her that her family is still around. Like if she is willing to take this journey with him to travel to hell, that she'll see them again and she may be able to rescue them. And so being a devoted mother, she doesn't hesitate. She jumps at the chance, even though she expresses some surprise and some indignation that her family would be in hell. She doesn't think that that would be the case. But travel to hell she does. And this is, again, another difference between the Divine Comedy. The people she runs into are a bit more modern, right? Because it is a modern retelling. So she runs into authors like Edgar Allan Poe, Aristotle, Plato, but also more modern philosophers in a way, if you will. People like Jimi Hendrix and Truman Capote and Agatha Christie. So people that are creative types who might be the more modern allegory to ancient philosophers, and a lot of other thinkers that Dante himself met when he traveled to hell. But she's not really accepted there, being that she's still alive. And toward the end of the issue, she's kind of shoved off a cliff, and it appears she's going to be judged by Judge K, who I'm not sure who that's supposed to be. Maybe if I was a little more versed in literature, it might be more obvious to me. I mean, there's even a lot of the creative types in the few pages where she's in limbo that I'm not sure about. I think one maybe is supposed to be William Shakespeare. There's another guy wearing a bandana that has some glasses and a bit of scruff on his face. I was thinking Lennon at first, John Lennon, but it doesn't really look like him. The scruff and the headband don't really look like him. So again, I mean, I'm sure about the Jimi Hendrix and pretty sure about the Truman Capote and the Jimi Hendrix and the Agatha Christie. But there's a lot here. There's a lot to be explored. And I think people of a certain age are going to get a kick out of it. And I think people that have read The Inferno and understand it and philosophize about it, I think they're going to get a lot out of this as well. And I'm anxious to actually talk to the person I know who's studying, doing her doctoral on the Divine Comedy, to get her opinion on what this book is about. But it's interesting because the mother doesn't, as I said, she doesn't believe that her family will be there, but she's going to take the chance because it's the only chance she's got. And again, she's not really living a life, so is she really sacrificing much? But she's also kind of no nonsense too. Like when she gets there, there's a few of those writers ask about their legacy, and she basically doesn't give them the time of day because all she cares about is finding her family. very single-minded in that search. And I think that that's very appropriate given where she's coming from, where she was, you know, kind of living in the past and almost a living ghost in her own house with the memories of her lost loved ones. So she's going to jump at the chance regardless of whether she believes, you know, she might believe there's a 1% chance she'll see her family again. She's willing to take that. And she's also not going to put up with any garbage from anybody because she doesn't care about anybody but her family. So that comes across as very appropriate as well. It's a 5-issue series, and I imagine we're going to see quite a bit of growth from this mother just because I can't imagine she's going to go through the struggle that she's going to go through to try to find her family and not have it affect her profoundly. So the series is off to a good start. There's a lot here. And again, the fact that Nadler and Thompson are adapting such a seminal work, such a, you know, I mean, the Inferno has been studied for hundreds of years, right? And the fact that they're turning it into a comic, updating it for a more modern world, you know, flipping some of the gender roles, I really can't wait to read more. And this is a book that I think it's flying under the radar a little bit. I haven't heard a lot of people talking about it, but I think if done right, it could be a book that wins awards and that people are talking about for years to come. So I'm very curious to talk to other comic readers who check it out just from a philosophical standpoint. I don't know if there is a whole lot in the first issue to start chewing on as far as sin and, you know, humanity and what humanity deserves and suffering and all that kind of stuff. But the seeds are there. The seeds are definitely there. So I certainly recommend picking it up, as I do most Aftershock titles, just because the quality is so high. As far as the art from Kyle Charles, it's a bit stylized. He does a good job of making the woman seem sufficiently downtrodden, I'll say. And the house, he does a great job of giving a sense of kind of dereliction on her part with keeping the house up because, you know, she just doesn't really care. Her family's not there anymore. And, you know, the house is sufficiently unkept, I'll say. And so it's a good way of setting the mood and the tone. You know, she's got slumped shoulders. She has kind of a worn face. And so it definitely sets the mood, sets the tone. You realize, you know, just how profoundly sad she is. And then the scenes in the underworld are rendered incredibly well. Also, the lines get a little wavy during the transition. So he does a good job there. And panels seem to, you know, the camera angle kind of tilts from one way to the other. The shades look, you know, gruesome, but not, you know, horrifying. Charon, who, you know, guides people who have died across the River Styx, looks ancient and supernatural. So that's drawn very well also. And again, the shades when she gets across look, yeah, they look pretty solid. Like, I mean, you can tell it's Edgar Allan Poe. You can tell it's Jimi Hendrix, Truman Capote. So it's very interesting. The colors by D. Cuniff are also handled really well. I especially love the cool blues she uses, blues and purples, when the mother gets to kind of the first of the nine circles of hell, which is that limbo area where these shades of these authors are hanging out, trying to get word of their impact in the real world. So it's a really great job by all the creators. I mean, the writing especially, the dialogue, as I said, having to create William Blake's dialogue with the rhyming scheme had to be a challenge. And just the fact that the writers are taking on this very ambitious and very interesting take, this modern retelling of the Inferno, my hat's off to them for sure. But Kyle Charles and Dee Cunniff as well. I mean, their contribution is definitely noteworthy. So anxious to see where this goes from here. And I have a feeling it's going to read very, very well when all is said and done and collected in a trade. So again, that's Her Infernal Descent, number one, on sale April 18th. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about is Rough Riders, Ride or Die, number three. And it's from writer Adam Glass. And we've got a co-creator and artist Patrick Olaf. And colors are by Gail Eltiab. So this is the same three creators who've been on the Ride or Die stories, I guess you'd say, right from the beginning. You know, this is the third and final volume. And for those not familiar, basically it's almost like an Ocean's 11 kind of thing, but with historical figures. So it's basically these historical figures being put together as a team to perform a task. The first one had to do with an alien invasion in Puerto Rico. The second volume had to do with a conspiracy from a foreign power to harm the United States. And this third one, Ride or Die, might be my favorite one yet because it deals with the supernatural. So kind of the dream team, or you could even think of it as a suicide squad in a way, although most of them aren't villains. But anyway, it's these collection of individuals being drawn together. And we've got Theodore Roosevelt, who's now actually president, Annie Oakley, Thomas Edison, Jack Johnson, Harry Houdini, Monk Eastman, and in this volume, H.P. Lovecraft has kind of joined the team. And, you know, as I said, it deals with the supernatural. It turns out H.P. Lovecraft can see dead people and they can communicate with them, I guess, kind of like the little kid in Sixth Sense. And so we find out in this issue that what the Rough Riders discover is that Roosevelt is the target, they believe, for this Dutch supernatural being, Bokenrider, Buckrider, if you will. It's basically someone who's dead, who, you know, comes back to life, has the power to raise other dead beings. They're basically making zombies. And these zombies are after something, and it has to do with Roosevelt and something that Roosevelt's ancestor did wrong. So, again, much like all the Rough Rider tales, it takes creative liberties with these historical figures. But he also tries to take, Adam Glass, the writer, tries to take events that happened in, you know, that really happened in history and give them a different spin. Right. So if you take something from history and it's supposedly it meant this, but in reality, there's another deeper conspiracy or another story kind of behind it. So that's kind of the thought here. It's just fun to bring all these historical figures together and have them working toward a common goal and just see the way they interact with each other, right? Because, I mean, in reality, they probably didn't know each other, or, you know, few of them knew each other. So to have them come together, and they don't have any superpowers, so it's not, you know, your typical, you know, superhero book. And it's been done before, you know, like Alan Moore with League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But I just love the concept of bringing these historical figures together. And again, I don't want to give away too much of what's happening in this particular book, because I want you to be able to read it for yourself. But I'll just say that Harry Houdini kind of makes a sacrifice to try to find out exactly why this Buckrider is coming after Roosevelt. And it almost seems like the Buck writer has legitimate reasons for it. I mean, like, it's almost justice. But the thing about it is it's Roosevelt's ancestor that made the mistake, right? So why should him and his family pay for it? So it's a solid issue. There wasn't a whole heck of a lot of action. It's more of an informational issue, kind of bridging the action we saw in issue 2 with what looks to be a lot of action going forward. So again, it's interesting seeing all these historical figures brought together, and they each, you know, have their own baggage and things that they deal with. And it makes for a very interesting read. It makes for a compelling read. And it's kind of tough when you take these historical figures and keep telling tales over and over and over with the same ones, because we know what really happened to them, right? So you can't just keep telling stories in perpetuity with them. But there was a Rough Riders special, Rough Riders Nation, I think it was called, that had a lot of different eras, and they pulled famous people from those eras and put them together and said, this was the Rough Rider team for this era, this was the Rough Rider team for this era, this was the Rough Rider team for this era. So there's still ways for Adam Glass to continue to tell stories if he chooses in the world of Rough Riders, which I hope he does, because it's interesting. But I don't know if anything can be as enjoyable as this team, just because Harry Houdini for me is a real favorite. But I mean, Roosevelt, Annie Oakley, just the way everybody reacts, and as I said, they all have their own little idiosyncrasies that they bring to the team, and it causes friction. And they're not a team in the common sense of the word. You know, they agree to work together when there's threats that are so great that they feel they owe it to humankind and mankind, basically, to work together to stop these threats. But they don't always get along, and then some of them don't seem particularly fond of one another. So, you know, it's not a team, as I said, in the traditional sense of the word. But seeing the friction and the drama is part of what makes the series so fun. And the art by Patrick Olaf, like it's been throughout the series, is incredible. It gets a bit gruesome at times. You know, it is supernatural. It is zombies trying to eat people's brains and stuff like that. But he does a great job of framing the panels. Pretty standard panel layouts. You know, a lot of triangles and, or not triangles, rectangles rather, and squares. So, you know, and he doesn't get too out there as far as panel layouts go, but changing the camera angle around in the panels, a lot of detail in the background. It's definitely a pleasure to look at. I can't find any fault with his rendering at all. And his storytelling from panel to panel is also exceptionally good. He does little things that with posture and gesture that really help with the storytelling from panel to panel, whether it's a character with a hand to their chin or a character that's got a hand on another character's shoulder that very much, you know, matches the dialogue on that particular panel. I mean, it's really good storytelling. I almost feel like you could understand what's going on without the words. That's how good the storytelling is by Patrick Olaf. But that's not to say that the dialogue and the scripting from Adam Glass isn't enjoyable, because it is, as I said, a lot of that interaction between the characters and what's interesting about the characters comes from the dialogue and the way that these Rough Riders relate to one another. So it's an incredible book. As I said, it's the last volume, at least of this team of Rough Riders. So I definitely recommend you go and check it out. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Aftershock Monday. Don't forget, you can go to lrmonline.com for all past episodes of the podcast. While you're there, be sure and check out all the other pop culture coverage, comics, movies, TV shows, all that kind of good stuff. I recently put up an article on LRM talking about Lost in Space, and my experience covering the Lost in Space panel and press room at WonderCon. And a lot of you enjoyed the article and reached out to let me know, so I appreciate that. And there was a lot of downloads for the little clips from the cast that I got at the press room. So I appreciate that. For those who are enjoying Lost in Space and haven't checked it out, I encourage you to go and do so. So twitter.com/thecomicsource is where we can be found on Twitter. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those platforms. All three places are perfect spots to find out when we're releasing new episodes, which is just about every day of the week currently. Also, when we do conventions and cover conventions, creator interviews, all that stuff, I'm always sure to announce on all three of those social platforms. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.